Hi, and welcome back to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast that spotlights some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. This is our first episode of 2017, so Happy New Year, and thanks for listening now and for the past 6 months. We took a little break for the holidays, but now we'll be back with a new episode every Tuesday. And today we're kicking off the year with Baltimore-based burlesque performer Kay Sirrah. Kay is a neo-burlesque performer, and she explained what that means, as well as some of the history of burlesque and its Baltimore ties. Burlesque is not stripping, but it's not any better than stripping, Kay said, and we talked about the politics of making that distinction. We also discussed the power dynamics at play in burlesque performing and feminism in the context of burlesque. Kay works with the Burlesque Hall of Fame as its head of communications and holds a day job, and she talked about the not always positive effect her performing has had on her 9-to-5 life. We also talked about inclusivity in the burlesque scene, evolving attitudes toward burlesque performing, and of course, sequins. Here's my conversation with Kay Sirrah. Is Kay Sirrah your real name?
In fact, it is. When I started performing burlesque, I decided that it was important enough to me to actually adopt it as my name. So my legal name is Kay Sirrah.
And how did you come up with that name?
Well, it's from the Doris Day song, Kay Sirrah Sirrah. And I liked it because of the play on words, because I spell it K-A-Y, like a female's name. And I liked the implication of what it means, whatever will be, will be. So it gives me the option as a performer to do a lot of different things.
How long have you been doing burlesque?
I got involved with burlesque in 2006 as a fan, and I fell in love with the art form. And after volunteering with the Burlesque Hall of Fame, after going to Vegas to see the shows, I just felt so empowered and inspired by what I saw that I started taking lessons where I could here in Baltimore. Trixie Little and the Evil Hate Monkey were in town at that point. And I took classes wherever I could, and I started performing in 2009.
What was your first exposure to it?
It was, in fact, an article in a competing magazine of yours about Trixie Little and the Evil Hate Monkey, and I like monkeys, and so I was intrigued and wanted to go see a performance, and did, and just loved it. I was very impressed by the theatricality of it, the fun of it, the sexiness of it, and the way in which it both harkened back to vaudeville-type entertainment, but also put a very modern spin on it. And so I was just hooked from there on.
Had you heard about burlesque before? Did you know much about it, or was this completely new to you?
I knew a little bit about it from older relatives. My great aunt was a fan of some of the music that was indicative of the period of burlesque in the 30s, somewhat in the 40s and 50s. And so actually when I was a very little girl, she taught me how to do a striptease, you know, pulling off a glove, nothing indecent, as a child. And I remember that just being kind of fun and doing a little bump and grind and, you know, having a little feather boa. But beyond that, I really didn't know anything about it. But when, again, I went to see the show in 2006 and became interested, I started learning more about the history. And, again, getting involved with the Burlesque Hall of Fame helped with that a lot.
Did you do any kind of performing before you discovered burlesque?
I did. I did some theater and community theater. And for me personally, one of the reasons that burlesque was so appealing is because as a performance art, you are somewhat obliged to do your own thing. You choreograph your routines, you pick what you'll be doing, you rehearse, you work with others to put together a show. But fundamentally, a lot of it is on you. And with a day job that was very demanding of my time, it was impossible for me to continue with community theater because I couldn't accommodate the rehearsal schedules. So I thought, well, if I can pick a performance art where if I don't have the opportunity to rehearse, the only person who's going to look like a fool on stage is me. I won't be ruining the lines for anybody else. Let's try that.
Has having a creative outlet outside of your day job always been something that you've sought and something that's important to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I still indulge in other art that I enjoy, sketching and painting and things like that. But when it comes to performance and getting that enjoyment of being on the stage and being that center of attention, burlesque was a wonderful outlet for that. And because it is, at least at the level that I perform at, which is in bars, in theaters, but I'm not Dita Von Teese or Dirty Martini or any of the other performers who tour the world. For me, it has a wonderful DIY necessity to it. And so it does give me a creative outlet that I wouldn't otherwise have, and has given me the opportunity to get involved in different kinds of creation that I might not have been involved in otherwise. I'm not a dancer, but I've had to learn how to do some choreography. I can barely sew a button, but I've had to learn how to make my own costumes. And it's just been such a wonderful chance to explore all sorts of different avenues of performance and being on the stage.
So in that way, it sounds like it's kind of true to the DIY spirit of many other communities in Baltimore.
It absolutely is. And I think that's one of the reasons why burlesque has done well in Baltimore, because of that DIY spirit. I think that's very, very true. The fact that I keep mentioning Trixie Little, she was a resident of Baltimore, and in 2015 she was crowned the Queen of Burlesque at the Burlesque Hall of Fame. Wonderful performer, and her boot camp classes and her DIY spirit and her love of Baltimore really came through and comes through in her work and was very inspirational.
So going back to when you started taking classes for the first time, what was that experience like, and was it something that came naturally to you? Was it difficult or awkward at all? Can you take me back to that time?
Sure. Well, being an only child of an only child and a Leo, it was not particularly difficult for me to want to be on the stage and be the center of attention. That absolutely came very naturally. But the moves of burlesque, the way in which an act is developed, the way that you characterize something, was different. And the classes had really helped me and continue to help me as I take classes still to develop that. One of the elements of burlesque that I think is particularly interesting is that there's a notion of transformation in a lot of the acts, and not just transformation from I have clothes on to I don't, but transformation in a more narrative sense. There are often in newer performers, you'll see transformation tropes that you may be very familiar with. The librarian into the sexy seductress, the Little Red Riding Hood and the wolf, things like that, mummies unwrapping, mermaids, things like that, that transform from one stage to another, one shape to another. I found that the classes really helped me to bring that forward. And the classes helped me to also see how burlesque is so welcoming of everything. There's no body type, there's no age, there's no gender identity, there's no anything that is restrictive. It's a very, very welcoming community. In the performances, you can see so much and so many different aspects of people's experience. It's delightful.
Do you think it's always been inclusive in that way, or is that a recent development?
Well, I think that it's a somewhat recent development in the sense of, if we look at the history of burlesque from the late 1800s through till today, as one can imagine, the inclusiveness of the theater shifted as the inclusiveness and societal norms shifted over the years. So in the late 1800s, the shows that came over from Europe and really started it here in America had one kind of look and feel, and Ziegfeld Follies, starting in the early 1900s, had a different kind of look and feel. So vaudeville changed a little bit and brought some more forward. Prior to that, the minstrel acts were unfortunately very popular, but it was the spirit of the time. And now I think we see something that's much, much more positive.
You describe yourself as a neo-burlesque performer, is that correct?
That is correct.
Can you tell me what that means and just describe burlesque for people who may not know anything about it?
Sure. I think the easiest way to think of burlesque is to think of Gypsy Rose Lee and to think of the kind of classic striptease that comes up when we think of the glove peel and the gowns and the sort of glamour of burlesque. Neo-burlesque, or the burlesque renaissance, if you will, started in the late 80s and into the 90s. In the 1960s, burlesque really kind of started to fade out, and part of that was because of, interestingly, the advent of jukeboxes brought live music out of venues, and go-go dancing sort of took over. And so burlesque really kind of faded away. And in the 90s, it came back, and neo-burlesque, and there are as many definitions for it as there are people who do it, but for me, it's a type of burlesque that tends to follow a more narrative structure of a storyline with a beginning, middle, and end, as opposed to the classic burlesque, which would be what I described in terms of the glove peel, the stocking removal, the long gown, and Gypsy Rose Lee, Lily St. Cyr type acts.
What about that narrative structure appeals to you, and what kinds of stories do you like to tell?
The thing for me that appeals about the narrative structure is, in terms of that creativity that you mentioned and that opportunity for creative outlet, I essentially have the opportunity to write a 3 to 4 minute story or play of what's happening to my character. For me personally, I tend to be kind of goofy and silly and stupid. And so my stories, if you will, tend to be a little bit silly or a little bit surprising. At least I like to hope that I like to think so. One of my routines is a reverse striptease, and I come out as Eve in a long blonde wig and 3 strategically placed leaves. And there is a tree on the stage that I approach, and of course there's an apple on the tree, as there would be, and I actually work a snake puppet that's hidden in the tree, and the snake then tempts me to take the apple, which I do, and then to continue the story, Eve then becomes empowered by what's happened. She doesn't feel shame in her nudity. She's actually kind of excited by what's going on. And she bites into another apple and finds some panties and puts those on. And then she walks behind some bushes and finds some high heel shoes. And those are amazing. So it's a whole narrative story of female empowerment. And at the very end, she kills the snake, tears it apart, and makes it into a boa that she then wears and sassily walks off the stage. So I like the idea of being able to tell that story. But for any of the acts that I do, the narrative I hope is communicated to the audience, but fundamentally, I also want the audience to have fun. Because for me, as much as I enjoy it, I'm getting paid to do it. And so I take it seriously in that regard. There are people who have paid to see an act, and I want to be sure that I give them the best act I can and that they have the most fun that I can deliver. So it's a very relationship-oriented transaction, at least for me. One of the things to me that differentiates burlesque from, say, theater is that there is very much not that fourth wall. So in burlesque, one of the things that I learned in classes and that I teach in classes is that the connection with the audience is very important. And so whereas in typical theater plays, you would not make eye contact with the audience and you would not engage with the audience in that way. But in burlesque, that's a very important part of most successful acts, that there is an apparent engagement and real connection with the audience.
Is it difficult to become a paid burlesque performer in general or in Baltimore specifically? And how did you get from, you know, just being inspired and taking a class to becoming a performer and changing your name? Like, what was that arc like?
Well, I think that there are many opportunities in Baltimore and D.C. to become involved in the community, to learn about burlesque, to learn how to do it. And there's, as with most kinds of theatrics, there's something of a learning curve and a journeyman experience. So a number of performers will start by taking classes and going to shows. That's very important, seeing what people are doing, seeing what other performers are bringing to the stage, and meeting them, saying hello, introducing oneself, and then becoming what's called a kitten. Because when strippers take off their clothes, someone has to come pick them up, and that's the stage kitten. So that person then gets to interact with the performers, help them, obviously, by picking up their stripper droppings, but also to become sort of a junior stage manager in a way. And so that's a level of experience. And then hopefully they will be given the opportunity to then add a performance in to the show and gain experience that way and sort of work up the ladder.
When was burlesque's heyday, and what would you say it was like at that time, if it's not right now? And how does it compare to what burlesque is like now?
Burlesque's heyday would be the 30s, a bit of a drop-off in the 40s, and then the 50s. So in the 30s, we saw Lily St. Cyr, Gypsy Rose Lee, Sally Rand in the 30s, and then in the 50s, Blaze Starr here in Baltimore, Anne Corio, Tempest Storm, a number of the names that some may still be familiar with. And in those days, there was a circuit that performers would go on. There were three circuits within the United States, much like vaudeville, again. And headliners would go from venue to venue and perform in these different bars or clubs. You know, how did it differ from what we see today? Well, the neo-burlesque movement and burlesque back in the heyday, it was a little rougher, I think, when we look at the touring circuit. So the women were very hardworking and were often very put upon. And in fact, in the 50s, a stripper named Jenny Lee created the Exotic Dancers League, and that was a union to try to get better conditions and safer conditions for the performers. And it was, in fact, that Exotic Dancers League and their annual meetings that slowly morphed into what has become the Titans of Tees reunion showcase that's in Las Vegas that is part of the Burlesque Hall of Fame. Today's touring performers, their experience is doubtless somewhat different because, again, society is different than it was in the 50s. But I couldn't speak to what their experiences are. I think that their experiences probably vary by person, as they did for the performers in the 50s.
I'm curious if the quote-unquote official feminist stance on burlesque has changed throughout the years. I know in regards to stripping, which burlesque is not, you know, in the 90s, Riot Girl kind of wave of feminism, it was very anti-stripping and, you know, you're doing that for men. But now in this most recent wave, we're seeing more acceptance of stripping, sex work. I wonder if that extends to burlesque as well, and just kind of a reframing of, you know, presenting yourself for yourself and not through the lens of the male gaze, if that makes sense.
It does. And that's a very interesting conversation, and certainly one that goes on inside and among different elements of the community. One of the things that I feel is important is when a line is drawn between burlesque and stripping, it's understandable because there's a difference in those performances. But one of the things that worries me a bit is that sometimes burlesque is put on a pedestal because in some people's opinion, it's less dirty or sexual or shameful. But I think it's important to remember that the women who are stripping today, when we think of like the pole dancing that one would see down at the block here at Baltimore, those women are doing what they need to do to be paid in that kind of venue. In the 50s, the performers who were stripping, the burlesque performers, were doing what they had to do for that time. But if we look at how things have changed, what they were doing in the 50s, which we now look at as somewhat quaint, is what they had to do. And so what the women have to do now to fulfill the needs of that job, it has simply changed. So it's just different. I think that from a feminist perspective, I think that as you indicated, there's been a positive shift to respect sex work And I would never say that burlesque is sex work, because strippers and sex work is far more difficult and dangerous, and burlesque is easier, and burlesque is not as dangerous. I am not put in the kind of situations that a sex worker would be put into, and I don't take those kind of risks. They are obliged to, and those are their choices. But I think that connection that I mentioned earlier with the audience, to me, that's one of the ways in which burlesque does define itself as a more feminist and empowering art, because the way in which I choose to reveal my body and myself and my character is entirely up to me in the definition of my story and my act. And my interaction with you as an audience member is defined by me. And typically, although there might be some tipping, it's not particularly common here in Baltimore or DC to do a lot of tipping of the dancers. And so my interaction with you is not likely to get me any financial benefit. And so that interaction is really because I'm in charge of what's happening. The performers are in charge of what's going on. And the fact that burlesque is so inclusive, as I said, of body types and age and everything else, I think is particularly empowering. I can't tell you how many performers I've met who have started up in burlesque because they wanted to feel better about themselves and they wanted to feel positive about themselves. And I think that burlesque has a great ability to do that, because it allows performers, mostly women, but men also, and regardless of identification, allows people to feel that sense of power over how they show themselves, and to be able to say with pride, this is who I am, this is what I look like. I'm not a particular ideal in one way or the other, yet I am still absolutely vibrant and dynamic and fun and sexy and serious or silly, but that's who I am. And when you're making that kind of statement by yourself on a stage, there's a lot of power to be had there.
Do you think that's what audiences respond to positively about burlesque? And what are the consumers and audiences of burlesque like, and what do they look for?
Much like any performance, I think everybody has their own different tastes. Everyone has their own styles that they like and different ideas of what makes a fun act for them to see as an audience member. The audiences in this area, and I think this is largely true from what I've seen in other areas where I've performed at different festivals and events, is about 60-40 female, and the age range of the audience is broad as well. I would say 20s and 30s, but plenty of folks in their 40s, 50s, and up. Some audience members are hearkening back to burlesque that they saw back in the day, and so they're eager to see something that might kindle some nostalgia for them. And I think that the expectation of the audience is, I believe, very similar to the expectation of any audience. They want to be entertained. They want to see performances that show professionalism, that are well thought out, well costumed, well choreographed, and well performed. And whether that means something silly and frivolous or something serious and deep, something with lots and lots of sequins, and actually that should always be the case in burlesque, lots of sequins and lots of crystals. But if it engages the audience, I think it's successful because it has come from the heart of the performer. And I think, again, in that sort of relationship way between the audience and the performer, it can be very powerful for both if that connection is successfully made.
It seems like in burlesque there's a deep reverence for history and for a knowledge of burlesque history. And the little I know about burlesque and have read about it, it seems that there's a little bit of, you know, looking down upon anyone who might not know their stuff, understandably. How much of modern performing is an homage to the history of burlesque, and how much of it is completely new and different and going in a different direction?
I think a lot of performance today is in a different direction. There's a lot of neo-burlesque, but classic burlesque does intrinsically harken back to and pay homage to the performance and style and creativity of the women who were the legends of burlesque's heyday. I think that like any art form, it's useful to know the history, to understand a bit of what came before, what people did before you, so that you're original, because there's an homage is nice, but accidentally or purposefully imitating someone is not necessarily nice. So I think that understanding history, while not mandatory, is beneficial. It certainly can't hurt to know more about what came before and to show respect to that. Performers all over the world, and that's another nice thing about the neo-burlesque movement or the burlesque renaissance, is that it really has become a worldwide phenomenon. The Burlesque Hall of Fame Weekender has seen performers from all over the world, from Australia, New Zealand, New Caledonia, France, Germany, just all over, and it's wonderful to see. And the understanding of the history of burlesque in this country, and then the different ways in which it manifested in other countries, like France, for example, doesn't really have a burlesque history in the same way that the United States does. It's a more cabaret-driven art form. But there are still similarities, and those different performance art forms can come together in burlesque in a way that I think now, because we are such a global society, we're seeing in a way that you simply couldn't in burlesque's heyday, because of course we were so much more separated in so many ways.
Many of us here in Baltimore know a little something about Blaze Starr, even if you know nothing about burlesque. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of burlesque in Baltimore and about some burlesque stars from Baltimore's influence on the art as a whole?
Well, Blaze Starr certainly does stand out as someone that so many people have heard of. And, of course, the block here in Baltimore still has the 2 o'clock club. And there's also a place called the Midway, which has a lot of burlesque history up on the walls that you can go take a look at pictures of performers from back in the heyday who came here to Baltimore to perform. The Gaiety was a very big stop on the circuit, and a lot of performers strutted their stuff on that stage. One interesting bit of burlesque history from here in Baltimore is that the term ecdysiast, which means stripper, was coined by H.L. Mencken, and he did so at the request of a Baltimore striptease artist named Georgia Southern, who was trying to find a way to destigmatize her work and didn't feel that saying that she was a stripper was getting across really what she did and the kind of performance that she did. So she asked him to come up with another word, and he came up with ecdysiast, because ecdysis is the shedding of skin. And so I have always enjoyed the fact that that term came out of Charm City.
And actually, I don't know if you noticed, but H.L. Mencken is here in our podcast studio.
Indeed,
yes,
indeed.
We have a figurine of him, and there have been photos taken in the studio where there's a bit of an aura around H.L. Mencken, so we don't know if he is, you know, sticking around here in the podcast studio. He might be haunting us, and I'm sure he'd be glad to know that we spoke about one of his words. Well, that does bring up the question of stigma. I mean, what are some of the stigmas that persist around burlesque?
I think similarly to the stigmas that persist around stripping, but to a different degree, because of course, again, it isn't the same, and sex workers are deservedly higher paid, and they put themselves and are at a greater risk. And I say put themselves, but really the situation is what creates the risk for them. So as a burlesque performer, certainly when someone finds out that that's something I do, they are sometimes surprised and somewhat shocked to think that, oh, you take your clothes off in front of people? And yes, I do. And so I think that the stigma that persists with burlesque is the stigma that persists with any revelation of the human body, and particularly of the female body, that in doing that, there's an implicit communication of a whole bunch of things that are not in any way necessarily true. Stripping is not consent. So the notion that I'm on stage and taking my clothes off does not mean that when I come out from backstage, I want to be touched. Just like anyone else, I would like to be asked before I'm touched in any way. And because I take my clothes off on stage does not mean that I will be taking my clothes off for you personally, because you have money or don't. They're different jobs. And so the stigmatization of a woman taking power and revealing herself in a way on her own terms, I think, can frighten people and make them feel uncomfortable. And I'm hopeful that as our society progresses, we learn better. I will admit that I'm concerned about the state of our country right now and the results of the election, because the ways in which women have been treated by our president-elect and the things that he has said about women, to me, puts me at a risk that I didn't feel like I was before. And perhaps that's my own naivete, but I feel now more concerned about being a burlesque performer than I did 2 years ago. I feel like maybe someone is going to think that it is absolutely okay to touch me or to say things to me that are not okay. So I'm hopeful that one of the ways in which burlesque as an art form and as just a small way can help is to be available to women and men, or again, any gender identification, to provide an outlet, to provide a place to explore and have fun and feel confident and not feel shame or fear for having fun and freedom with one's own self. We talked about classes, and I believe that it's very important to continue to learn in any interest or any hobby, any art form, whatever one does. I think continuing to learn about it is important, because otherwise I feel like you just stagnate. So we're teaching a series of classes here in the spring, and we're bringing in performers from different areas of the country to teach the different classes, so that folks here in Charm City will have the opportunity to learn the art form and have fun, and I hope build that kind of empowerment for themselves, whether or not they ever want to set foot on a stage, just to have that feeling of ownership over one's self and control. If that can be imparted to a dozen folks, then I'll be happy.
How much emotional energy does it take for you to set and enforce those boundaries, and do people typically respect them?
It takes as much force and strength, I think, as it does really for any woman almost any time. Again, I feel like that's a greater concern now than I felt like it was 2 years ago, and that may just be my perception, and I'm sorry that the clouds have been lifted from me, really. I think I would have preferred to stay naive. But I believe that, personally, I have a responsibility to set my own boundaries and to be clear about them. And when someone is violating those boundaries or looks like they're about to, I feel like the ownership is on me to stand up for myself. And I feel like there can sometimes be an expectation that society will protect me, or that common decency among others will protect me. And I haven't seen that. And what's happened recently to me makes it clear that I can't rely on the kindness of strangers, if you will, that I have to stand up and say, don't touch me. This is not a petting zoo. Back off. Don't say that to me. And that can be awkward. And as a woman in her late 40s, I was not brought up to stand up in that way. Generally speaking, coming into feminism when I did, and you know, coming into age in the 80s, there was still a clear expectation of being polite, even in situations where you were not being treated with any kind of courtesy. But the expectation was to just sort of grin and bear it. They'll stop if you just ignore them. I'm no longer comfortable with that kind of passivity. And while I don't necessarily walk around looking for trouble, I do feel strongly that now I'm obliged to speak up. Not just for myself, although that's all I can immediately impact, but I feel like it's my responsibility to step up for myself, so that perhaps the person I'm reacting to will think better of it next time, and perhaps someone else won't have to step up in the way that I did.
Did burlesque help you unlearn some of those behaviors?
That's a great question. Yes, I think that it did. I think that going on stage and putting myself in a position which certainly could suggest an openness to propositions that you might not think of someone who was serving you dinner did compel me to develop a different set of behaviors to address those misconceptions. And I found that very empowering as well. Initially, it was a little bit difficult to get past what I had learned about just kind of smiling and nodding and gritting my teeth. But it did, burlesque has helped me to develop a thicker skin and to use that not as a way to ignore, but in fact feel like that thicker skin is a protective armor so that I can stand up and I can say what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not.
You mentioned earlier some people reacting in a surprised or taken aback manner when they find out what you do. Has there been any pushback or any negative consequences in your life outside of burlesque because of burlesque?
There have. I've had situations with my job where people have found out through third and fourth channels that this is something that I do, that burlesque performance is something that I do, and it has not gone over well. And I've had to shift from one client to another because a particular client was not comfortable with it. And despite the fact that the two worlds never meet, that there is no influence of any kind from one day job to the evening job, if you will, the stigma of stripping was problematic for this client. And I was very lucky that it was not worse. There have been situations in the DC and Virginia area where people have lost their jobs. And it's a dreadful thing to think that a woman could lose her day employment because of something that she does on her own time. But because it's stigmatized, because it involves, from a perception standpoint, involves quote-unquote sex because you're showing your body. And so follow that terrible path down the road to hell of, oh, you're showing your body. Well, then clearly you're probably giving it away or selling it. I don't know which would be considered worse in that mindset. But that would be enough to say, well, you don't deserve this day job because you're doing this terrible, questionable thing at night.
Do you ever feel like you're living a double life, or does it ever take a toll on you to have to, in some ways, hide away this big part of your life?
It has been somewhat stressful for me on occasion, but not too bad. I've been pretty fortunate, knock on wood. But again, I have had friends who have decided to stop performing because they are genuinely scared of losing their job because, it has happened. And I would say that the double life aspect of it for me has not been terribly stressful because with the exception of day job work, I'm fairly open about it. All my friends and family know. My mother helps me sew costumes.
When you were going through that difficulty at work, was there ever a question of you stopping burlesque?
I did think, what will I do if this doesn't go away? If I'm not able to ameliorate this situation and reestablish these boundaries, what am I going to choose? And it was difficult, but I would have had to choose my day job as the thing to keep because mortgages and adult responsibilities. And much as I absolutely adore burlesque and am so grateful for all the fun and opportunity that it's given me, with few exceptions, it's not a particularly lucrative field. And it's a very difficult way to make a living. And those who do it as their sole profession can attest it's hard work. It's late hours. It's long hours. And again, for not a particularly considerable amount of cash. And I have a mortgage.
Are there many people who do it as their sole type of work, or do most people also have a day job like you?
You know, I don't know what the breakdown is between folks who do it 100% as their profession and folks like me who are sometimes referred to as hobbyists. I don't particularly love that term because I feel like it's somewhat pejorative and dismissive of the the commitment that I put into burlesque. But be that as it may, it is not my job. For those who it is a job, I would venture to say that it's, again, not unlike one might see in other performance art, particularly in the theater. There are those who commit to becoming an actor and do all the things and work all the hard jobs that go along with trying to advance in that field. And there are those who do community theater and keep their day jobs. So I doubt very different from other art forms in that way.
Is there a lifespan for a burlesque performer? And if so, when do you think you would stop or tap out?
Another great question. Well, again, one of the things that's so wonderful about burlesque is that it is so inclusive, and you can start burlesque performance as soon as you're an adult, and you can stop when you die. And the legends of burlesque's heyday, the performers from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, they are still, some of them, performing. And in fact, the Titans of Tees showcase that I mentioned that happens at the Burlesque Hall of Fame in Las Vegas, that event has been going on for, I think this is the 60th year. And the women who perform at that showcase are the women from burlesque's heyday. So these are women from the 50s and 60s and 70s. And last 2 years ago, we had a performer who was 91. And we've had performers in their 80s, and a lot are in their 70s, coming out from the 1950s and 1960s. And these women get on stage, and they don't just stand there and take a bow. They do their acts. So these are women in their late 60s, 70s, and 80s performing striptease for an audience of 1,000 people who are all losing their minds loving it, because the respect and admiration for what these women did back in the day and what they're still doing is tremendous. And it's, I find it extremely inspirational to see these women just putting it out there in a way that society absolutely shuns. Because, you know, if we think that women are questioned for going on stage and revealing their bodies, you can imagine how the general societal thought is about someone in their 70s and 80s doing the same thing. You know, women in Hollywood, as we know, you know, you hit 45 and your last blankable day, and you know, that's it. You can play sexy people, and then you're someone's mom. You're someone's mom who's actually 2 years younger than you in reality. And in burlesque, you can keep going and just keep going.
So it seems like burlesque really challenges a lot of people's stereotypes and pushes them in a provocative way, perhaps.
It absolutely does, because the image of, quote-unquote, a stripper as a young, perfectly bodied, large-breasted, athletic, gorgeous thing, and that's lovely if that's you, but is not the requirement. It's not the norm, even. There are performers who are much more Rubenesque, and they are adored. And there are performers who are older. You know, I don't imagine that you would go to a bar on the block and be likely to see a stripper in their 50s. And you would certainly be able to see a burlesque performer in her 50s. The openness and inclusion of it is, again, so much of what I find amazing about the art form, and that it is so welcoming to everything. And the fact that it balances on that pinpoint of it is sexy. I mean, there's no denying it. You're taking your clothes off on stage. That's sexy. That's forbidden. That's just not something you do. So it's fun, it's nasty, it's naughty. And the fact that you can do that from 21 straight on through, I think is wonderful.
Is there anything that the burlesque scene is lacking or that you'd like to see more of, or the next wave of burlesque?
I don't know that I would say that it's lacking anything. I think it's changing, much like any art form does. It's changing and evolving. There are, as we talked about before, there are certain styles that I like. I like to see performances where people have, in my eye, really put a lot of attention to detail in there. A class that I took from a performer named Dr. Lucky, who's based out of New York, she once said, taking off your bra and underwear is not stripping. Going to Victoria's Secret and buying a cute little bra and panty set, getting on stage and taking it off, that's not burlesque. That's not what we're trying to do. And sometimes I see performances where, to me, it looks like that is what the person has done. And I'm disappointed by that. But there may be other audience members who find that completely satisfying and very much enjoy it. So I think that there are performances and performers for every taste. If you prefer classic performances, you can find that. You can find wonderful performers who are in fantastic beaded gowns and incredible glamour and headdresses and just absolutely over-the-top, poofy, Hollywood-era glamour. If you want something that is much more actual performance art and there's ropes involved and liquids and things coming out of different places, you can find that. If you're looking for, you know, the storyline of the mermaid or Little Red Riding Hood, if you're looking for that sort of familiar performance, you can find that too, which is another thing I think is so welcoming about burlesque, that there's not just an opportunity for different kind of people to perform it, but for the audience member, if you go around to different shows, you can find different performers and performances that will suit your taste.
Kay, what is next for you?
I will be traveling to Alaska for the Freezing Tassels Burlesque Festival. And then in the spring, with the Creative Alliance, I'll be hosting a series of classes called Burlesque for Every Body. And it's being put on by Body Shop Productions. And that's where we're bringing in the instructors from all these different areas. So we have Jo Boobs, who is the headmistress of the New York School of Burlesque and the author of the Burlesque Handbook. Tigger, who is the original Mr. Exotic World and the king of boylesque. We have Poison Ivory. She is the current reigning queen of burlesque. We have Darlinda, Just Darlinda, who is a renowned performance artist out of New York City. And we have the boss of burlesque, Foxy Tan, out of Minneapolis. So we have a wonderful, wonderful series that culminates in a student showcase, which is always a delight. And these classes have been such a joy to provide and to be part of and to see these new performers, many of whom not only is burlesque new for them, but any kind of stage performance is new. And so to take someone from I've never set foot on a stage to 6-7 weeks later, I'm on a stage and doing a burlesque number, and to just see how much fun they have, it's absolutely a treat. It's a privilege.
Thank you so much for speaking today. That was great.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and each week on this podcast, I interview a compelling local woman for the Baltimore Sun. You can listen to Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble and on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist, who was the first guest on this podcast. Feel free to send me an email at qkelly@baltsun.com. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.
Dope Girls! Dope Girls! Dope Girls! Keep